I'm Father Mitch Pacwa, and welcome to EWTN Live, where we bring you guests from around the world. St. Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 6, verse 20, that we were bought with a price. For most of us, living our Christian faith in North America isn't that hard, not that dangerous, but it wasn't always so. Our guest tonight have been traveling the United States telling the story of a Jesuit missionary, Father Jean de Brebeuf, and his Jesuit companions, who ministered to the Native American Huron people in the first half of the 17th century. They were in an area around what is now known as Ontario, Canada. And they paid the ultimate price for sharing their Catholic faith and became saints of the church by formal proclamation of Pope Pius XI back in 1930. Here to tell us more about the ministry and life of Saint Jean de Brebeuf, please welcome two of my Jesuit brothers, Father Joseph Hill and Father Michael Wagenka, as well as Mr. Isaac Beck. Gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you here in Alabama.
Thank you, Father Mitch.
You all get around a little bit anyway. You normally live where, Father Joe?
I live in Tampa, Florida at Jesuit High School, Tampa.
Yeah. And I live in Denver, Colorado at Regis Jesuit High School.
And you are not a Jesuit, but you live where?
In Muscoota, Illinois.
Okay.
Yeah, all outside right. St. Louis.
All right, good. Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
Why are you here if these guys are here? What are
yeah,
you doing?
Yeah. Well, we want to take extra special care of this relic. So I'm the guardian of the relic. They have normal everyday jobs as vocation promoters. But during my gap year this year, I had the flexibility and the friendship with them to help make this tour happen.
Gap? This is a store you go to?
No, it's a modern phrase for taking a year off after college to discern or plan out your next move.
See how these kids come up with new words all the time for us old people to learn. That's great, though. And so folks understand, we have here the skull of Saint Jean de Brebeuf, and you also brought a couple other relics with it, correct?
Correct.
What are they are?
Yeah, so there are two other Jesuit priest missionary martyrs. On the left is St. Gabriel Lalemant. It's a piece of his rib. And on the right is St. Charles Garnier, and it's a piece of his fibula.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And in fact, we also have from our Jesuit high school in Miami this painting of the martyrdom of St. Jean de Brebeuf. But who's in the background?
Yeah, so that's Gabriel Lalemant there as well.
Okay.
He was tortured right after St. Jean de Brebeuf and died on March 17th, so St. Patrick's Day. And
yes.
Actually in the Martyrs Shrine Church in Canada, they have a stained glass window of St. Patrick in there.
Okay, to commemorate that was the day of the martyrdom.
Right.
Okay, it's a lot better to remember that than remember rivers turning green or people drinking lots of extra beer. I never quite understood the celebration of the great evangelist of Ireland with beer. Hadn't been invented yet. Okay. Now, this is something of the story of it, and I'd like you two fathers to tell us a little bit more. It looks like there's some sort of decorative neck wear, but that's not what that is it?
No, so this painting, which is in the chapel of the Balin Jesuit High School in Miami, it's a fairly new commission of a Spanish artist, Raul Berzosa, and it depicts the martyrdom. So there are a number of elements. This is a very, very gruesome martyrdom. One of the Indians who was captured with the Jesuits was able to escape, and they were also able to recover the bodies. So they were, we know exactly what happened to them, both from the account of the Indian and then also the Jesuit missionaries who recovered the body were able to kind of verify his account by looking at the wounds.
Now, and by Indian, one of the issues in the Martin was that different nations were involved. The ones who did the martyrdom were which nation?
So they were the Iroquois, who were the enemies of the Huron, and the Jesuits ministered to the Huron. Or the Wendat. The French called them the Huron. So, so here are some parts of the martyrdom. They were captured after an attack on a village, and they were brought to another site where they were tied to a pole. And then scalding hot water was poured over them. That's what this cauldron represents in mock of baptism, three times, poured it over this skull, scalding hot water. They took red hot pincers and pierced the body in multiple places. And they heated up axe heads to red hot in the fire and then created a necklace and then put the necklace around the shoulders of Saint Jean de Brebeuf so that when he leaned forward, the axe head would burn his back. And when he leaned back, the axe heads on his chest would burn his chest. So it was just a form of torture. They were playing games.
Yeah, see, that's a couple of the things about the kind of torture that was exacted from the Iroquois is that they very much wanted to break a person down to show that he's not a strong man. That was part of the reason for the torture, to make you wince in pain.
That's right, but Saint Jean de Brebeuf was a strong man.
Yes.
And all the time during his torture, he was praying and exhorting the Indians and the other Jesuit to remain steadfast and to look forward to the rewards of heaven. And this actually infuriated the Huron, the Iroquois. So they eventually chopped off his tongue to prevent him from praying.
Yes.
And then smashed his jaw off. Yes, he was very, very strong in the face of torture and endured a great amount of suffering.
And that eventually evoked admiration from the Iroquois.
Exactly.
You want to say, Father Michael?
Yeah, so the Huron had long admired Saint Jean de Brebeuf for his strength, that he was known as the man who carries the heavy load, or Ekon. And so he had this extraordinary strength to be able to carry a canoe and a pack on portages between lakes and rivers for long distances, and the Huron admired him tremendously for this. But that was just one example of his strength, and during his martyrdom, even his enemies, the Iroquois, admired his strength and his silence in the face of his torturers, his blessing of those who were with him, that they, at the end, as he was dying, cut open his chest and took out his heart and ate it in order to have a share in his courage.
Yeah, they understood the heart as the organ of courage.
Exactly.
You know, and we oftentimes see the heart as, you know, talking about somebody having a strong heart, or the, you know, and not just as a muscle, but as a symbol of, you know, that strength of character. So they wanted to eat his heart. Then they did eat his heart.
Right.
One of the things that we can read in the testimony of the martyrdom of Jean de Brebeuf came from another Jesuit that was in the mission with him, Christophe Regnault. And in that, there's a book called The Jesuit Relations. These are a large series of the stories of what the Jesuits did. If you go to a lot of libraries, you can find them. They're some of the most important reports of the Native Americans in the 17th century that you'll find, including dictionaries of their languages, etc. But in the documents from 1649, Father Regnault wrote, quote, Father de Brebeuf had his legs, thighs, and arms stripped of flesh to the very bone. I saw and touched a large number of great blisters, which he had on several places on his body. From the boiling water, which these barbarians had poured over him in mockery of holy baptism, I saw and touched his two lips, which they had cut off, because he constantly spoke of God while they made him suffer. I saw and touched all parts of his body, which had received more than 200 blows from a stick. I saw and touched the top of his scalped head. I saw and touched the opening which these barbarians had made to tear out his heart. We buried these precious relics on Sunday, the 21st day of March, 1649, with much consolation. On one hand, when you think of another priest coming along and personally witnessing that level of torment, you would wonder, why would he experience consolation? You know, that, you know, those of us who have seen the movies made by the Third Reich of the torments they did in the concentration camps usually evokes disgust. And it's meant to be disgusting. Now, this is that there's a demonic quality in what the Nazis did to make us disgusted with humanity, and that's typical. But Father Reynaud had felt this consolation. And I think it's connected with something we had talked earlier about. They took a vow of martyrdom. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so St. Jean de Brebeuf's spiritual life is very interesting. We have some of his diaries and some of his writings. And over the years, it was a very difficult mission, and they suffered greatly to get to the mission and then staying in the mission because the conditions were very primitive. Mm-hmm. But he came to embrace this suffering as a way to draw closer to Christ, mm-hmm. as a way to embrace the cross. And he calls it a delight to be able to suffer for Christ and with him. So I think when they talk about the consolation of seeing the wounds, I think it is in recognition of the love, the incredible, unbelievable love that he showed in the suffering, in donating himself, in sacrificing himself, or his friend, seeing his friend be sacrificed in this way, and the merit that gained in front of the Divine Majesty for the people that he ministered to.
I think for folks to begin to understand that too, it's important to remember St. Paul's line in Colossians 1:24, when he said, I make up for what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ by my sufferings for the sake of his body, the church. That when we unite our sufferings with Christ, it's not just that I'm becoming some sort of spiritual athlete able to do. No, it's about a union of suffering with that of Jesus for the sake of the salvation of the church, only because it is united to Jesus.
Yes, I think Jean de Brebeuf would have made the third week of the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola and would have contemplated the Passion and would have been moved by consolation of seeing the wounded and disrespected body of Christ, and perhaps even meditated on taking this body down from the cross and laying it in the tomb. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Jesuits meditate on, and the consolation of being near to the Lord, of being one of his disciples in the midst of his great affliction, I think is something that allows us then to also even reverence the body of our Jesuit brothers, especially with that same sort of reverence.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an important part of this, because it's not a consolation of saying, oh, good, you know, he suffered. No, that's there's a deeper understanding of the meaning of suffering. One from the other martyr that died with Saint Jean, I'd like to quote from Saint Gabriel Lalemant, one of the other French Jesuits. And it says, "It is my God, my Savior first, to make good the obligations which I feel toward you. For if you abandon your contentments, your honors, and your comforts, your joys, and your life in order to save me, wretched one, is it more than reasonable that I abandon, after your example, all these things for the salvation of souls, which you esteem yours, which have cost you your blood, which you have loved even until death?" This sense is very upfront for Saint Jean, that this is for this, the good of the souls, including of his enemies, the Iroquois that were torturing him.
Yes, it's a mystery. The mystery of the cross, the mystery of our salvation being worked out, not in glory, but in suffering and death. And the missionaries, certainly, because they meditated on it many times, but they lived it, found in it consolation, right? And they realized that what they were doing and what they were sacrificing and what they were suffering was for the sake of the salvation of the souls that they were ministering to. And we know that during the martyrdom, Saint Jean de Brebeuf prayed for his persecutors and his torturers. So a man of incredible love and just on fire. He was on fire.
In terms of some of the elements that apply to modern life, sometimes I wonder whether part, not all, but part of the difficulty in calling people to religious life and to the priesthood, whether men or women, is that we have an expectation of fulfillment in life, but we try to define that in ways that may not be quite the same way the martyrs defined it.
Yeah, I think our fulfillment is in doing the will of God, and I think joining Jesus Christ in his mission to save souls, that is the greatest fulfillment and the greatest consolation. And I think that's what drew Jean de Brebeuf to enter the society and to become a missionary to New France and to eventually give his life for these people, was that he recognized that Jesus Christ had shed his blood also for them. And he wanted them to know this and to be helped by what he was offering them, by what he was preaching.
Certainly one of the great examples for these martyrs had been another one of them, Saint Isaac Jogues, who had been captured and then escaped with the help of a Dutch merchant who hid him on a ship and got him to New York, and then he went back to Old France. During his first torments, the women in the Iroquois village had chewed off his fingers, especially these four that were used for holding the Eucharist during Mass when the priest elevates the Blessed Sacrament and holds it with these four fingers, that it was normally an impediment for ordination, that if you didn't have those fingers, you probably would not be ordained a priest, and they knew that this was special, and so that's why they chewed them off. And he went to New France, was celebrated, you know, everybody, oh man, this is a great hero, and then he wanted to go back to the Iroquois, right, and got special permission to be able to celebrate using other fingers, so that he could hold the Eucharist with these fingers instead of these four, because he didn't have them anymore. And then he also was martyred the second time he went. That was part of the example that these French Jesuits had in going there.
Yeah.
I think it's actually remarkable if you think of it, these Jesuit superiors sending these guys to New France under the expectation that some of them would die. And you gain something of an insight into how they thought about the world and what they thought was really important. Mm-hmm. I remember during COVID, you know, so many locked themselves in their houses and, you know, were afraid of getting the virus. Mm-hmm. Would Jean de Brebeuf have been locked in his house during an epidemic like that? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. They were willing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of the mission. And Jogues, obviously, I mean, he longed for it. Isaac, are you named after St. Isaac Jogues?
Yeah, that's one of my patrons is St. Isaac Jogues. So I read about him as a little kid, and it's hard to imagine him going to such lengths to go back to Rome and get special permission to say Mass again. And the Iroquois woman must have known how much he loved the Blessed Sacrament. I even heard one account described him as a man glued to the Blessed Sacrament. Mm-hmm. Like that was their one sense of consolation out in New France, where they didn't have the beautiful churches like they had back home. Mm. They were out in the wilderness and around a culture that didn't always act as morally as the people in France did too. So he's a huge inspiration to me for sure.
Yeah. One of the things about this too, I forget how many years ago, it was back in the 80s, that a movie came out called The Mission that was about the French priest going there. And one of the things that you see in the movie is that as you know, what folks did not know back then, Europeans were mostly carriers of smallpox. They had no idea of what it meant to be carried. They had no idea of bacteria and viruses. And you know, originally smallpox came from a North African gerbil. That's how it had gotten to the humans. And Europeans came here and just by breathing near Native Americans who never had that disease, many died. And they, in that movie, they showed the priest going around and just doing quick mass baptisms. But in fact, you know, before their martyrdom, they had spent a lot of time teaching the Native Americans the catechism. They didn't just sort of want quick baptisms to get numbers. They wanted people to make a commitment to the faith. Had you read much about that element?
Yeah, no, so St. Jean, you know, he was there in the Huron mission 3 years, the first 3 years, and they did not baptize a single adult who was not in danger of death. Mm-hmm. Because, and then when they went back, and it was another 3 years before the first adult fully accepted baptism and was received into the faith. They were very serious about ensuring that those who received baptism would live the Christian faith and would not relapse. So, yeah, they were very patient. And I find that patience very moving. I'm a very impatient person myself. I want everything right now.
Yes.
But imagine St. Jean de Brebeuf in the mission territory 6 years before he baptized his first adult. I mean, what did he do in year three and year four? Did he despair? Did he think that, you know, what he was doing was going not to bring out any fruit? You know, I ponder on that, and I'm very challenged by it.
And, you know, this is something where when the Huron people did begin to understand the faith, they did so with great commitment. You know, and their own lives were at risk as well, you know, for becoming Catholic. This wasn't easy for them. And even among the Iroquois, Mohawks were one of the seven nations of the Iroquois. And one of them became the great Saint Kateri Tekakwitha, who her shrine is right across the road, practically, from the Jesuit shrine.
of St. Isaac Jogues.
Yeah.
Now, she's in a remarkable...
That's the one in upstate New York, not the one in Canada. Yeah. She lived in upstate New York.
Yeah, and I think it's also remarkable that Jean Rabouf was such a gifted linguist that he came to New France, and he no one had written a dictionary or any tools for him to use to speak the language, and so he had to compose them himself. Mm-hmm. And he also wrote a catechism in order to be able to explain the faith, and had to come up with words for God and for Savior in order to be able to explain the faith to them. And it was a remarkable accomplishment.
Yeah, and the spending the time on the language to really be able to communicate the faith mm-hmm. allowed the people to truly understand it, and then when they did convert, to truly embrace it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you said, I mean, some of them became somewhat ostracized from the rest of the tribe as a result. Obviously, they had to live a different life morally and spiritually mm-hmm. from the others. And St. Kateri, I mean, is an incredible example of that. Someone who got smallpox herself
yes.
and recovered, and then wanted to consecrate her life to God. And, you know, they were a little bit hesitant, I'll be honest, the Jesuits were a little bit hesitant to accept that, knowing what it meant in the tribal structure, but eventually they...
Because there was no equivalent of a committed life of chastity. That right. was something so out of their ken in these... The number of people was so small, they felt the necessity of women being able to have children just so that the tribe could continue to exist.
No, that's right. It's interesting that they did not understand why the Jesuits did not take wives themselves.
Yeah.
And at first, they thought that this was some kind of rebuff or dishonor until the Jesuits finally explained that they lived a celibate life. But yes, it was a very new concept. Yeah, and so Kateri did consecrate herself, and then she lived with the sisters until she died. But it's a remarkable example of how the fruit of the first missionary to land in this territory finally was brought about through patient, you know, sowing and cultivating many years later in the life of another saint who was herself indigenous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in that ability to teach... You know, well, first of all, like we, you know, the Jesuits studied a number of languages. Yes. They had to do all their coursework in Latin. Of course, they knew French, and they usually knew Greek and usually some Hebrew. So they knew languages, and they used that background to even create the idea of a dictionary. No Native American had a dictionary. That never would have occurred. They didn't have books and writing, and they didn't have, a grammar. They just passed on language as they spoke. And these Jesuits worked so that not only they, but others coming after them could learn the language and expand the catechism and translate the Bible. All these things are very important. And one of the results, I'd like to give another quote mm-hmm. From one of the Huron Indians who gave a very loving testimony about the death of Father Jean de Rabouf and the other Jesuit martyrs. And it's also found in the Relations. It seems to me that we should not mourn over the death of these good fathers. Their torments are over and their joy will never end. If they loved us on earth, they will still love us in heaven. For goodness does not go to ruin in that country. For myself, I desire to imitate them. They remained in perils that they might assist those who were unable to flee. This one desire to aid them for the sake of their souls, and the love which I have for the faith and for prayer, will keep me near those who give their lives for us. To, you know, realize that this is a fairly new Christian.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And it's a very profound understanding of the smallness of suffering in this life compared to the eternal glory of heaven, and that his recognition of love here. Think of the catechesis that helped him see that love would be in the next world in heaven and not disappear. That was not part of Native American understanding of life after death. I mean, like most ancient people, they thought of life after death at its best, a continuation of life here. You know, but the idea of loving, that wasn't so much part. Any further reflections on, so? Well, actually,
it's interesting, yeah. The one thing that the Jesuits were able to use as kind of a bridge into the culture was the fact that they did believe in an afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
The Indians did believe in an afterlife.
Yes.
So they could speak about the soul and the soul surviving the death of the body.
Yes.
But you're right, they had a very strange, and they thought that it was a material existence after death. And so this idea of a spiritual existence, a communion, a union with the Creator, was radically new for them.
Yeah.
So, but this is one of the things that the Jesuits were able to preach that the Indians could somewhat understand. And mm-hmm. so that became a way in.
Yeah. We need to take a little break. Well, I want to come back on that point and follow up on that, because that's an important point. But we'll be back, so please stay with us. Welcome back. We are with a couple of my Jesuit brothers, Father Joseph Hill and Father Michael Wagenka, as well as with the custodian of these relics, Mr. Isaac Beck. And we're talking about these Jesuit martyrs of the first half of the 17th century, but especially Saint Jean de Brebeuf. He's one of seven of these martyrs. And we were just discussing before we had to take a break that Native Americans had a fairly strong sense of life after death. And when you study ancient anthropology and archaeology, you see something similar, that the goods of everyday life are typically buried with the dead. Sometimes weapons, other utensils, certainly various kinds of jewelry. Might not be, fancy jewels the way the pharaohs did, but, the way that people decorated themselves with shells and feathers, other things that were fairly typical. And this goes back to the earliest Homo sapiens, and earlier than Homo sapiens, even back to Neanderthal people, that they also buried, often in a fetal position, so they're going back to Mother Earth, and they'd be covered with red ochre to show that it's as if there's a kind of life, like blood, but there's a kind of life after death. But the Jesuits were able to give them, the folks there, a sense that we share that. And that, as you were starting to say, that was part of the original evangelization.
Yeah, though that was very important. When they came to understand the culture, what they found was a lot of superstition. They were gods and small gods doing this, that, and the other, especially in the natural world. But so obviously they couldn't really work with that. But when Saint Jean understood that they had this strong sense of the afterlife, that they revered the dead and that they buried the dead in ritual ways. Mm-hmm. He was able to latch onto that. And much of their preaching, especially early on, was about the afterlife and how this life was a preparation for that and that there would be a judgment. There was heaven and there was hell. Mm-hmm. And they definitely preached that, yes.
And the classic insight that I think most of the ancient pagans of Europe, Asia, and Africa didn't like to think about this life as a preparation. The Egyptians did. They're one of the exceptions. But most people had such a vague sense of life after death that they didn't think of this life as a preparation, but they did see the next life as a continuation. That's why they put their tools and weapons and things in a grave. And the Jesuits communicated another sense, and the Christian burial was something that impressed the Native Americans.
Yeah, so when the first Huron converted and were baptized, unfortunately, one of the first Huron who was baptized with his family, he ended up dying in an epidemic, in fact. But so they gave him a full ritual Christian burial. And the people were very, very impressed by the beauty of the ritual and how reverent the Jesuits were with the looking after the body, the saying the mm-hmm. prayers over it, mm-hmm. and then eventually burying it. That this drew more people to listen to what they had to say.
And it would have a sense of seeing that, you know, what's obvious compared to life after death, this life is extraordinarily short. You know, we have a Jesuit in my province who is, I think, 102. And he said, wow, this goes by fast. I mean, I've known him for 56 years, over half his life. And so, you know, but he and other elderly people say it goes by real quickly. Eternity lasts forever.
Yeah.
So that's an important perspective, that death is not the end. And we read that quote from the Huron convert who understood that from his catechism.
Yeah, and I think in this painting, above the painting, which is cut off, we don't have the heavenly part at the top of the painting, actually. But at the top it says, your present sufferings are fading or are going away, but your recompense will be forever. And I think even in the sufferings of Brebeuf, he proclaimed to them the truth that this present life, our sufferings, the dangers that they encountered in the wilderness, that these were temporary, that these were passing away, but the fidelity to Jesus Christ and to his passion, that would be something that would last forever. And I think that was a compelling witness to the natives.
And this was something that, you know, filled Jesuits, not only that came to New France in North America, but other of our Jesuit brothers were trained in France to be missionaries in England, where they were killed by Queen Elizabeth, King James of the Bible fame, and by the Puritans who came after the monarchy. You know, they just kept going, knowing that this life is short anyway, and we want to preach the gospel. And it happened in South America. It happened in the Orient, the Eastern Asia, Southern Asia. It just was something that was part of the commitment to serve. And I know that both of you priests are doing vocation promotion. That's what your assignment from the provincial is. Why are you bringing these relics of Saint Jean, Saint Gabriel? Why are you bringing these in the notion of helping to promote vocations?
Because this younger generation needs heroes.
Yeah.
They don't have heroes. And many of the heroes from the past have been torn down for them in our culture today. But we have some incredible heroes in the history of the church, obviously the saints, many whose lives are far in excess in greatness to anyone who's lived, let's say, here in recent times, in my mm-hmm. opinion anyway. So we want to tell the story of St. John de Brebeuf to inspire people to imitate him and to give their lives like he did for the mission, for the salvation of souls. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's our hope, one of our hopes.
And this is just an outstanding example of donation of one's life, of self-donation, and of handing one's life over to God, to the Society of Jesus, to the people that you're sent to as a missionary. And that's something that I think can really speak to the hearts of young men and young women who are considering their religious life. This man held nothing back. And I think there can be a question in the hearts of many young people today of, well, if I give myself entirely to something, there will be nothing left for me. What will be left for myself? The answer is nothing, but you don't need anything for yourself. God is enough. And I think the witness of Jean de Brebeuf is a compelling testimony of that. And also, I mean, his intercession is powerful, and the number of healings, physical, miraculous healings attributed to him. And so this whole tour is actually under his patronage and is offered to his intercession for vocations to the society.
Well, actually, you've brought a number of the petitions that have been, as you're taking this tour, people are bringing their petitions for healing from cancer and a variety of other illnesses and family situations, asking for his intercession. That is also an important part of any of the saints, that we seek them to intercede for us.
Absolutely. Yeah, and this is just a small number. We actually have a whole box. We're running out of space, and we're going to have to get something else to contain them. But the prayers, some have been for a share of St. Jean de Brebeuf's courage, for his strength, for reconciliation, that he's a great reconciler between Europeans and natives, and so that can provide hope for any relationships that need reconciliation. But then also, of course, physical healing. He suffered so terribly in his body, and so anyone who experiences any kind of suffering in their body can look to him as an example of how to persevere and how to turn to God and offer up sufferings with the passion of Christ.
Yeah, I think as far as this reconciliation issue, we have a lot of folks who in our present political climate that want to see the tension between people exacerbated. There was the famous Saul Alinsky, who, for his political promotion, you had to choose an enemy and personalize the enemy and, you know, go after them and make them hurt and then win a victory over the enemy. That was the whole gag. Mm-hmm. And I say that as someone who had been an Alinsky organizer back in the 60s. And it's not a good idea. I learned the hard way. It's an anti-Christian notion. Whereas he loved his enemies and preached and prayed while his enemies were towards him, exactly as Jesus had done on the cross. This is a very important element. I was wondering, I don't know how much you talk about vocation also to marriage, because the marriage vocation is in horrendous crisis. As not only from divorce, but now the majority of children are born to unwed parents, and because people are afraid to give themselves in a commitment and stay together with their spouse and their children. Maybe your spouse is not perfect, but it's a lot better than St. Isaac Jogues' friends. I mean, you know, so that he helps put that in perspective.
Yeah, well, no, we live in a crisis of commitment in general.
Yep.
And people want to pick up and then put down things when they no longer need them anymore or think that they don't need them. And of course, the Christian life is the exact opposite of that. Jesus emptied himself, taking on the form of a slave. He poured himself out for us, and he gives us the example, and we're supposed to pour ourselves out, as Michael said, Father Michael said, St. John Brebeuf did. And that's what every vocation is, every Christian vocation. Certainly marriage is a form of the cross as well, can
be. Absolutely.
And we must embrace that. I'm so tired in myself of complaining about my suffering. Why am I complaining? Let me embrace it. Let me allow the Lord to use it to transform me and to love through it and let it teach me to love.
And one of the great takeaways for me from this whole tour was simply that Jean Brebeuf, in every single one of his sufferings, he recognized that it was only God's permissive will that allowed him to experience these sufferings, and that somehow in the mystery of God's plan for his life, this suffering was permitted to him in order that he could glorify God in the midst of it. And I think if we open ourselves to that perspective, that this suffering is permitted by God for his glory, I think we can see a little bit of the cross and perhaps grow to embrace our sufferings a little bit more fully with God's help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in some of his spiritual writings, he writes about how the Blessed Mother was a model for him in her surrender to the will of God and always saying fiat. So mm-hmm. I think that was a strong consolation to him. But when I think of St. John de Brebeuf, I think that he reveals Jesus Christ to us and mm-hmm. Jesus Christ, how he revealed the Father. Mm-hmm. Like we've been saying, a total self-gift for love. And it's inspiring because it shows that it's possible, but also it requires great humility and just trusting that you do God's will where you're at with what you're given.
And you certainly see that element in St. John and the others. And there's another element too here. Do any of you remember what was the name of the governor of New France at this time?
Champlain.
Mm-hmm. He's one of the few political leaders from that period that we might know, only because they named a lake after him.
Yeah.
And now it's very pricey property. But most of the other officials who thought of themselves as being fairly important are pretty much forgotten. Yeah. You know, it's one of the great ironies. I oftentimes ask people, do you remember the name of the empress at the time of the birth of Jesus? No. But you'd remember the peasant girl from Nazareth. Yeah. The empress was, she got Octavian, Caesar Augustus, in power. And at least according to Suetonius, she took him out by poisoning him at the end of his life. And she put in her son as his successor and her grandson as his successor. But nobody remembers her. But the Virgin that you just mentioned, Our Lady, who just said, let it be according to your word, her you remember. And by the way, it was Livia.
Okay.
Yeah. But
no, it's one of the paradoxes of Christianity is that those who in human terms seem to be complete and significant in their time, the light of their spiritual lives and the greatness of their virtue shines on and is then therefore revered years and years later and picked up, whereas the great names and the great lights of the moment of their time are completely lost and forgotten.
Yeah.
And so it will be in our time as well.
Yeah, of course. I think that's going to be the case. And I think that's one of the elements of vocation.
Yes.
If you are called to a vocation to religious life, like we've been, as well as the priesthood, or in a case of other people's brothers and sisters and a number of monks who are called to religious life, it may seem to be giving up stuff, but you're putting yourself at a service of God and his people that makes this, I'd seem to say, more than worthwhile. It's not a matter just of, the thing that is worthwhile seems superficial. You know, we are privileged, you know, in the priesthood especially, to be with people at the key moments of their existence. You know, baptizing them after their birth, being there to give them the last rites, mm-hmm. confessing, you know, sins that they don't want anybody else to know, but they trust us. Being there as they start a family and marriage. I mean, we're highly privileged to be part of their lives. And that's, and to realize, yeah, it entails some element of giving up. Yeah. But I don't think any of us have given up as much as Saint John of Buffalo.
There is sacrifice, but unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains a single grain. Mm-hmm. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. There must be sacrifice for fruit. Mm-hmm. And to give is, as it says in that beautiful prayer of Saint Francis, it is in giving that we receive. And that is the paradox of, I think, one of the paradoxes of the Christian life. That it is in loving and giving of ourselves that we've received more. But tell that story, Isaac, of you know, Saint John of Brebeuf saying what it was worth to save one soul.
Oh, yeah.
That's great, because it touches on this point.
So he was the only priest who knew the language early on, because he mm-hmm. was adept with languages. Mm-hmm. And there was an Indian family who had a baby who was dying. So late at night, he rushed over to their house and tried to convince the parents to allow him to baptize this little baby. And eventually he convinced them to, and they agreed. And he baptized the little baby, went back to his superior later that night. And his superior said, I bet you must be feeling good after spending all this effort and being successful. And Brebeuf says, ah, I would have traveled all the way across the ocean just to reclaim one little soul for Jesus Christ. And it was just beautiful to hear that.
Yeah. See, this, and, you know, as we get called, I mean, the 20th century was the most violent century in history. And there were more than half of all the martyrs of the church were martyred in the 20th century alone. 40 million out of 75 million martyrs. And, you know, it's a risk, too, to live our faith. And we have a lot of enemies of the faith, you know. And I think some of them, if they could martyr us, they would. But this is something where we can, again, look to St. John that, you know, have to ask God's grace to stand up for the faith the way he did.
Yeah, I mean, his courage was singular. One of the most courageous men ever to have lived.
Yeah.
And he showed courage, of course, in his martyrdom, but all throughout his missionary life. And remember, when he arrived in the Huron Territory, he was the first Frenchman to have ever gone there. I mean, he was an alien among, you know, people who he didn't know what they were going to do to him.
Yeah.
So, no, a man of great courage, and we have to draw strength from that courage today and from his example. I've been preaching about that and the places that we have been visiting on tour, that we should have courage.
Yeah.
In the face of persecutions, small and great, because we are united to Jesus Christ, and he is our strength.
And he's the one who keeps saying, be not afraid. The world wants us to be afraid so they can manipulate us. That's exactly why they cause us fear. We listen to Jesus instead. Fathers, thank you. Mm-hmm. Isaac, thank you very much for being with us. Fathers, would you join me in giving our audience a blessing?
Absolutely.
May Almighty God bless you and keep you and cause his face to shine upon you. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
And we can bring you these relics and the story about this great saint, our guests, only because this network is brought to you by you. And the same is true for all of our other programs. So we ask you to please keep us in between your gas bill, your electric bill, and your cable bill. If you do that, we'll be able to pay all of our bills too and bring even more fine guests and Catholic events such as this to you. God bless you all and thank you.